And if you could just tell us who you are and where you're from, please.
Mary-Ann Di Gelinato, Director of Corporate Services at Maroondah City Council, so local government land. And thank you, Treasurer. It's just so delightful to always hear your positiveness about infrastructure and what the next 12 months looks like, given that us in local government are putting out our budget in the not too distant, and to get the feedback from the community. Great to hear about investment, great to hear about triple bottom line funding. One of the things that is keeping me up at night is the whole recycling and waste matter. And I'm just wondering if you've got any little hints in terms of the budget going forward, what numbers might we be looking at to put contingency in for local government budgets?
Thanks very much. Look, I probably will surprise you with the answer in the sense that all will be revealed in the budget. But can I, from a broader perspective, say we understand and recognise that local government have seen the financial model underpinning the way that recycling has been managed, waste removal has been managed to date, has changed quite dramatically and quite adversely to the interests of local government. As a government, we've already provided short-term assistance, but we recognise that there will be a need for further interventions. And can I just assure you that we are looking at effective ways, not just to help you with the short-term problem, but to start to get our recycling industry on a stable basis going forward.
More questions from the audience? All right, while you're warming up, Treasurer, firstly, I have to observe you've done a terrible job of being negative in your comments, obviously. The optimism has run through. You highlighted the fantastic economic performance of the state. You talked about population growth. I'm interested in hearing your views about the role of population and immigration in economic development in Victoria's future. It's obviously an issue that's become more contentious and being debated around the country. So I'm just interested in your reflections on that and how the government is planning on sort of managing that and thinking about that in the 5 and 10 years ahead.
Well, I suppose the first answer really is the states deal with the consequence of essentially migration policy, which is Commonwealth responsibility. But I think we need to be a little bit more direct with people than that, and that is to say we've been quite supportive of the migration levels that have come to this state. And we've seen that they've been net producers of economic wealth across the state. There are three things my department tell me that really fire the Victorian economy, the three P's as they put it: population growth, participation in the labour market, and productivity per capita. And those three things have put us in a pretty strong position. I think as a state we've benefited greatly on the back of migration and population growth. I know it brings with it attendant concerns, like people get pretty unhappy given the level of congestion on the roads and on the public transport system. But there is a flip side to that, and the flip side is they are substantial wealth generators. I had my department do some work on, well, what is the profile of a typical migrant to this country and to this state, and how long does it take before they are net contributors to our economic well-being as opposed to a drain on the state's capacity? And it takes about 5 years. We've got a lifetime after that of contribution to the state. And I think we do need to have people who are prepared to champion the idea of migration, recognising that the Commonwealth, who recently asked us a rather banal question, how much do you think population or migration numbers should be in your state? Well, the answer to that is it depends. It depends on how much governments, state and federal, are prepared to invest in order to deal with the attendant pressures that increasing population has upon the economy and upon the state's livability. But certainly from our perspective, I prefer to deal with the problems of optimism and growth than the problems of disinvestment and disinterest from people who could otherwise call this place home.
Thank you. Do we have a question from the audience? I'll keep scouring. If I miss you, please jump up and down. I have to say I was actually pretty taken by the numbers you were quoting on unemployment, and particularly in the Latrobe Valley. And I think that may have come as a surprise to many in the room, because those transitions are things that we haven't always managed well, not just in Victoria, but across the country. One of the things that people are very focused on now and looking ahead is the impact of technology. It was a question that came up earlier. And how we think about technology displacing jobs and what we do about that. How are you and the government thinking about that as, not just in terms of industries that we've already lost, but what the potential opportunities and displacements are from, a rapidly changing technological environment and how we try to get ahead of that and manage the transitions and the disruptions before they become more costly than they might need to be?
Well, I suppose the first point I'd made is with regard to the Latrobe Valley, they're not through the woods yet. We can see that this industry will be subjected to continuing pressure through the nature of the generators that are there. We're keeping a close eye on the investment and maintenance that those companies are putting in. And we do know that we are in a transition period around energy generation, and the government has a role to play. That's why we put $266 million into the Latrobe Valley Authority to assist in the ongoing event. Having been around politics a long time, I think I've been involved in three rescue packages for the Latrobe Valley, and I think the Premier had a much different approach to it this time. He said, let's make a substantial investment, but let's demonstrate to the community that we're here to stay, and that we're going to make an investment in the future, and we'll be making continuing investments to assist them with what will be a very substantial change. On the broader question about, what is the government doing with regard to change and the changing nature of work, the changing demographics of our industries? I suppose the first thing I'd say is state treasurers and state governments shouldn't get too full of themselves. We're about 1/7, really, of the GSP of the state of Victoria. Sure, that's a substantial part, but it's not the majority part, and we have to have good partnerships with the private sector. If we don't, we delude ourselves about our leadership role in the economy. Because, what was it, Lewis Carroll once said that, if I'm not good to my feet, they might not take me in the direction in which I wish to go. Well, we need to recognise that, when the rubber hits the road, when the walking starts to progress the economy, it's the private sector that does it. We have looked at where the growth is coming through in our economy and where the shortages in skills exist in our economy, and we are making quite deliberate efforts to encourage people to go into those areas of employment. Our free TAFE initiative is not, free across the board TAFE. It's free for those areas where we have skill shortages and where we can tell people you've got a high probability that you'll pick up long-term jobs of the future if you get these job-related skills. And we're going to continue that effort. The revitalisation of TAFE, I think, is one of the key reforms of this government, but it's also a clear sign of where the government sees it can make a key intervention by improving the skill base of the labour market and to recognise that what we sell to the world as a state is our people and their expertise. That's why the services sector is so big as a percentage of the economy in this state, more so than any other state. It's because we sell skills and capacity to the world.
I'm going to change topics now, and you raise the issue of Commonwealth-state relations. I'm going to put a bit of a plug in for some research that CEDA's launching or presenting here in Victoria as well. We've just released a paper on our view of the budget, and one of the things that we call out, it's a big chunk of that is about the long-term structure of the budget, and one of the things we actually call out is how financial arrangements between the Commonwealth and the states have changed so fundamentally over the last decade or so. So following a wave of consolidation of agreements and partnership agreements, we're sort of back to The number of agreements well in excess of 70, and the detail of those agreements being quite surprising, really, in terms of the level of control the Commonwealth is exercising in those agreements, or oversight of quite small projects, essentially. Yeah, how do you... You talked about the enforceability of the agreements, but more broadly, is it possible to get back to a different position in regards to those agreements, and how do you play a role in that, or you and the other state treasurers, and is it possible to get to a point where there's probably clearer lines of accountability?
Well, I hope so. I mean, one of the great things that frustrates me about Canberra is I have this theory that when the wheels of the plane hit the tarmac at Canberra Airport, people become instant experts on everything that states do. They've got, 7,000, 8,000 public servants in the Federal Department of Health in Canberra, and I'm going, what on earth do all these people do? Well, I'll tell you what they do. They drive round and round in circles, and they drive states round and round in circles most of the time. Effort, I'm not saying that we should reduce our public sector size, we should put them to good use, is what I'm saying, and essentially working cooperatively with the Commonwealth is a key part of that. It's a clear sign of how dysfunctional our federation has become when all of the states and territory treasurers sit around a table and say, look, let's not bother about working with the Commonwealth so much. Let's set up our own forum where we take responsibility for the things that we can influence and manage ourselves. After all, some of the big productivity changes that are affecting this nation have been driven by states. Case mix management, to name one example, but the national reform agenda, essentially another example of it. States have to, if they're going to have a mature relationship with the Commonwealth, have to demonstrate that we are not simply mendicants constantly calling on the Commonwealth to give us money, but that we have clear plans, we've got a better service delivery strategy, we know more about it, and the Commonwealth has to recognise that their job is essentially a funding provider, a protector of the public purse. By all means, satisfy yourself that the states are not ripping off the taxpayer, but don't try and treat states like they are entirely owned subsidiaries. We aren't. We are the progenitors, effectively, of the Commonwealth. And if we get to a position going forward that we're essentially left to run our own show, I think the nation becomes worse for it, because you get this policy dysfunction where states do one thing and the Commonwealth does another. Well, the way to avoid that is to deal with each other responsibly, reach agreement on plans, and reach some measure of mutual respect that we know what we're doing, and let us get on and do it.
Now, I think we've got a question over here.
Thanks, Treasurer. My name's Connie Lenneberg from the Brotherhood of St Lawrence. Just going back to the previous topic, it's really great to hear about the optimism and also really evident the level of economic activity and going forward. We also, however, know that with the changing nature of work and also the uneven investment across parts of this city and parts of the state, there are places and peoples who are being left behind and who are not really finding a way in to share that prosperity yet. So particularly children, we put out a youth unemployment monitor just recently which showed 18% unemployment for young people in Bendigo, 17% in Shepparton, and it's higher in the western suburbs, clearly it's still around 14-15%. Also older workers, particularly women, and then new immigrants and refugee communities. And I just wonder if you could share your thoughts about how we can make sure that more of those groups, we've certainly seen those groups have more of a share, but how we can really shift that entrenched place-based and people-based poverty going forward. Thank you.
Well, thanks for that. Look, youth unemployment is one of the great scourges, I think, in terms of the functioning of our economy, because the longer people are out of work, particularly if their first experience is a difficulty of gaining work, impacts upon their approach throughout their life, and it can be intergenerational. We've seen youth unemployment reduce by around about 2 percentage points since we've come to government, but it still remains unacceptably high, and there are areas of evident geographical disadvantage where those numbers do peak. So from our perspective, education is the great liberator, but the government recognising beyond that, that we have to continue to make access to skills-based training more available to those most exposed groups. I suppose the final point I'd make is that we have to continue to use our procurement strategies to help those who are particularly disadvantaged. So you've seen already through our procurement strategies, we are insisting that those who get big capital works programs with the state of Victoria employ people from the Aboriginal community as a requirement. We are now looking to see whether we can extend that to other areas of disadvantage. Now, that does cost the state every time you put a condition upon the obligations that our constructors have to meet. That's a cost that they have to bear, and they'll incorporate that into the price that they apply to the projects that they deliver. But I think if we're going to break the back of intergenerational disadvantage, if we're going to be in a position where we can say to young people, there will be jobs, there will be jobs that will be here for a long and viable future, and you need to undertake training to secure those jobs, then we have to basically be prepared to put our money where our mouth is in terms of the policies that assure them of ongoing employment.